This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good evening, I'm Ezra Zayed alongside Caroline O. Now, 2 weeks ago, many of us were shocked at the death of Soundgarden frontman Chris Cornell, who coroners concluded died from suicide by hanging. The loss has been hard to swallow, but what his fans and loved ones are having difficulty digesting is the fact that it was suicide, a far cry from the man known to many as a doting husband, father, and overall responsible man. His wife has alluded to the fact that an extra dosage of Ativan, a medication that Cornell has been taking to help ease anxiety symptoms, was what caused it. This sad demise is reminiscent of comic legend Robin Williams passing back in 2014. He was suffering from severe depression at the time. Depression and mental health issues are still very much a hushed discussion in all societies. It is encouraging to see influence figures drumming up awareness the way Princes William and Harry are doing with their charity Heads Together. It's an organization that deals with mental health issues, something the princes went through after they lost their mom, Princess Diana. Sadly, that type of awareness is what's missing here in the country. But our guest this evening, clinical psychologist Dr. Chua Suk Ning, is trying to change that. Dr. Chua, welcome to the show. And so last March, you were involved with a play titled Remedy, and it's a play that addressed mental health issues. You acted as an advisor and had a Q&A session with the audience after the play. Tell us, what was the response like from the audience?
I thought it was really great. I think the audience is ready to interact with such issues and really start talking about how mental health has affected them and what sort of treatments they are. The purpose of the play is to say that psychotherapy is helpful for anyone. You know, it's really, I think, it is an effective treatment for individuals with mental illness, but it's also really helpful for anyone who's just going through a sort of a tough period to talk to someone. So rather than saying, okay, mental illness only has to be dealt with when it's very severe, even when you're feeling a little bit down or you're having some sort of anxiety or you're having a difficult time maybe getting to work, it's helpful to talk to someone rather than just saying, I'm just going to bear with it, you know, get suck it up and keep moving on, because we don't want to wait till people are severely depressed. You know, like prevention is definitely, I think, the way we want to move forward.
So with the play yesterday, I shouldn't say yesterday because it wasn't it's a pre-record. So with the play and the whole Q&A session, what was the response like, actually?
I think people felt that these were issues that they could really relate to, you know, parents who have high expectations of them, millennials, well, not just millennials, but I think people who are trying to figure out their path in life and, you know, are they satisfied with the things that they're doing. I think what's very common nowadays is that, you know, if you're not satisfied with your job, but you feel that you should be, you know, you feel that somehow you should be grateful that you have a job and this time, so just suck it up and keep going. And I think that sort of feeling, people end up feeling really trapped and constrained, and that then affects sort of the mental health. So I thought that the audience really could relate with the issues that every day it just becomes harder and harder to bring yourself to work. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, they're feeling more and more guilty that you are struggling.
Yeah.
And then you could kind of see that character. I think his mood just became lower. So we didn't want to diagnose him because we didn't want to say that, you know, mental health is only, you should only be concerned with mental health when it's severe. We wanted to say all of us, you know, all of us have a mind and all of us have mental health that we should take care of.
Yeah.
We should promote. Yeah.
So I take it the response from the floor was good, it led to a vibrant discussion. And was that surprising for you? Because I think we come from a base where we assume that there isn't a lot of awareness that goes around, that people are not comfortable talking about it.
Yeah, definitely. It was very surprising to me. I mean, I teach, so it's very surprising to me to have really vibrant discussions. You know, as a lecturer, I'm constantly trying to get students to engage with me.
And it's just not happening.
Yeah, yeah. I deteriorate to blink if you agree. So, but so just for the audience, I think to be brave and to have, I think, signify that it was such a safe space for them to bring out personal issues mm-hmm. and to talk about things that really affected them. And so I was very impressed with the way things were going.
And so based on, because you've done a lot of research, obviously, within this area, so with that safe space and people coming out and talking about issues that they may be going through at this point, did the numbers pretty much correlate to your research on the issue? The numbers of people responding versus the numbers of people based on your research?
Hard to say. Mm. I mean, I think this is... It's a self-selected group of people who are interested in this issue.
And that's why they're at the play.
Right, yeah. And that's why they're at the play. I think there are lots more people who we haven't touched yet. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why we keep needing to promote this idea of public awareness of mental health issues.
Earlier you spoke about, this attitude of bearing with it or sucking it up. Mm-hmm. And just on that topic about millennials and how they're experiencing a lot of the different challenges, how they're expressing it.
Right.
Are there different generational attitudes about how to sort of deal with problems and how to express them in a particular way?
Yeah, I think that probably in the past, maybe there were fewer options. You know, people got married a lot earlier, a lot younger. And so if you have a family and then maybe you didn't have to, I would say in a way, like you didn't have the time to feel much. So if you think about Maslow's hierarchy of needs, their security needs weren't there. So they were concerned about how do I get food on the table.
Right.
And in part of it, what we do see with development is that mental health conditions actually increase as a country gets more developed. We saw that with China, we saw that with US, and now I think we are seeing that with Malaysia. Wealth and prosperity also brings about stresses of life and the deterioration of the family unit, less social support, and that then also increases mental health conditions. So I think right now, possibly our parents' generations also suffered from, certain individuals suffered from depression, anxiety, sort of the common mental illness, but they didn't know what to do with it. And now with the conversation opening up, I think more people are coming forward to say, hey, you know what, I feel down and it is affecting me and how can I talk about it? Whereas back then, maybe it did affect them, but nobody knew.
And how did people respond to it or how did people...
Back then?
Yeah.
Man, I wish I could travel back in the future and I could tell you that. I think that, you know, if I had those conversations with my parents and just asking them, you know, how did you think your generation handled it? No one just talked about it. I think
it was just all pent up.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons why I actually went into clinical psychology. So I'm not even that old, but even when I was younger, just nobody knew what to do. You know, like it was this unknown thing. If someone had depression, you're just like, well, let's just, I don't know, maybe we'll pray for you. But there was no diagnosis. There was no treatment. So what do you do when you can't do anything is you don't do anything. You know, you kind of like suck it up and keep going on. And then obviously the demands of the family, if you had to take care of young children, you start paying attention to that. It doesn't mean that your mental health is getting better. It just means you can't afford to get better yourself because someone else is in need. Yeah.
So that's back in the day, but it doesn't seem as though it's moved that much. Well, maybe, you know, it's not the circles that we move around in, so we're not, you know, very familiar. But am I correct to assume that it feels as though it hasn't moved that much? People still put in a corner; they can't recognize it. They're aware that, you know, mental health is important,
yeah.
But in actually identifying it, we're still far behind.
Yeah, I think, we do see a shift. It's slow and steady that people are saying mental health is important. Whether or not we are at the, we are where we should be, where people can identify and say, hey, I need help. I don't think we are there yet. And part of it, I think, is that it's still quite stigmatizing. I think part of it is that people don't know what it is about. There's a lot of misunderstanding about mental illness. There's also sort of, you know, maybe friends and family members say, let's not talk about it. Don't tell anyone about it because the institution will stigmatize you about it. You know, so if, let's say, I was suffering from depression, will I lose my job if I came forward with it? Right now, there are no laws protecting you. There's no laws protecting employees from that. Many corporations, if any, not that I know of, have policies that explicitly protect people from being fired if they come forward for treatment.
Yeah.
So I think that the institutional support isn't there. And of course, then you have societal discrimination. And then not to mention that when you're feeling down, you feel down towards yourself as well. So there's also that self-stigma attitudes that you hold. So all in all, it's very difficult, I think, for people to come forward. And so the self-stigma won't change until the society starts saying it's okay, until institutions start putting in place policies that say it's okay and will defend your right not to be okay by providing avenues for treatment, by protecting you from losing your job.
Yeah, and those seem to be the, I mean, just the basic steps, isn't it? Will I be able to get help? Will I be able to keep my job? Will they look at me differently? And if you can't seem to cross that initial threshold,
right,
it seems you'd be in a lot of trouble. So what data do you have locally about how suicides affect Malaysians specifically?
Well, we have sort of the official numbers. So the official numbers, MP YB Ong Kim Ming kind of asked at Parliament question. So it averages about 227 people a year commit suicide. At least that's just recorded, you know. So officially, that's about like one person every 2 days. Unofficially, which is also from the MOE publications and so what we know from WHO, is about 12 people per 100,000. So that's about 10 a day.
10 a day?
10 a day.
And I can't tell at this juncture with how big that number is or how small that number is, I guess, in comparison to other societies. Is that something that people even think about?
Yeah, we are average.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Fortunately for this one, I mean, we don't want to be very high. We could be lower, but right now, I think the numbers are, we're about average. So 12% would be the average rate globally.
Now, when we come back, we'll be speaking about suicides, why it happens and why we still don't address it in our society. Stay tuned to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're back with Caroline and Ezra on the Evening Edition, and we're addressing the issues that come with mental health and suicides, something we've been hearing a lot of lately. Speaking to us about it is clinical psychologist Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and picking up from where we left off earlier about the spectrum of mental health, Dr. Chua, how bad does it have to get before we enter into this space where suicidal considerations are at play?
Right, so let's think about that. The data shows that about 80 to 90% of people who commit suicide suffer from a mental health condition. Usually suicide happens when there's a lot of hopelessness, when people don't feel that there is anything else to be done. And so often it's quite severe. It's the thing about suicide is that it's quite impulsive in some ways.
Right.
So they found like people who were stopped from jumping off the San Francisco Bridge. So let's say out of 500 people that were stopped, only 25 went back to actually do it again. So that would mean, you know, about like 500 people, 490 people. For them, it was at that moment, they felt really helpless. And it was been something they've been thinking about to act on that that thought. Impulsively in that sense. I'm not saying that they never thought about it, you know, or didn't take any planning, but that means that when we help people, there's a chance that they won't go back to do it. So I think that's why it's important for us to start talking about it and to say suicide happens when people do feel hopeless and it is quite severe, But it doesn't mean people will remain in that space forever. Yeah.
Do you have any idea of the demographics that you're talking about? So the sort of official numbers that came out that you mentioned a little earlier.
Right.
Any further breakdown to that?
No. This is officially the numbers are not talked about much. There are reasons to keep it a secret. I think that, you know, it's for a number of reasons, I guess. People don't want families to feel ashamed of it. I think families don't want to talk about it. So in some ways, you're protecting the privacy of the family members. The government or the society may not want to alarm other people at the high rate of it, so we don't talk about it as much. So there's not much information about the breakdown of it.
But do you think that's detrimental, the fact that these numbers are not transparent, the fact that we're not talking about it?
I think so, because that means we don't know the severity of the issue. You know, it's not talking about it doesn't actually make the problem go away. And so if we start talking about it, and I think in a very sensitive way, with options for treatments or avenues to how to get help, then that would be very helpful. So let's not, I mean, we're not just talking about like suicide for the sake of talking about suicide, but we bring up the issue and then we want to point people to resources and to tell, I think, society that we need more resources for this.
You spoke about how, you know, for folks who are considering suicide, there's an element of impulsiveness about it. Then how do those who care for person A or person B, how do they respond? How do they detect these signs of concern?
Yeah, I think that sort of the warning signs include, you know, feeling hopeless or withdrawing from social interaction. One thing that even as a young trainee, as a psychologist, I was very afraid of bringing up the topic. And I think that's a very common response. We don't want to talk about it in case we implant the idea of suicide.
Right.
But research actually shows that's not true. And in talking about suicide, if people want to commit suicide, they will. And if they don't want to commit suicide, they won't.
So it's not about how much or how little you talk about it.
I'm not implanting it. In fact, when we talk about it, there's a bigger chance that we can actually help someone. Mm. And so the first thing is, if you feel that someone is an imminent threat to themselves or to other people, that's emergency help. You know, it's not for you to go and stay with that person or feel guilty if anything happens, but that person actually needs urgent help, then you should go to the ER or call 999. So it's out of the realm even for private clinicians like myself. We're ethically bound and legally bound to bring someone to emergency. What you can do is try to talk to the person, be empathetic. There is something called the no suicide contract. Like if you feel like harming yourself, can you promise that you'll call me, for instance?
Right.
Or can you promise that you won't harm yourself for this period until we get you help? So I think at that point, you want that person just not to act on the thought, but then to also say, let's get some help. And we're not going to force you. We're not going to push you. But let's think about that. Yeah.
And it's not the case that the attraction to the idea of suicide gets stronger over a period of time. Is it just something that needs to be addressed and dealt with?
I think you need to address the suicidal ideations and the thoughts of it. I think suicide as an option in some ways to end the suffering will become more attractive if that person ends up suffering more. You know, because that's really at that point, and there is no other option but that option. And so saving someone from suicide shouldn't end there. Our job doesn't end there. We need to then say, okay, so what led you to that point? And how can we help you not end up there again?
And when you do encounter cases of suicide, does the way in which they killed themselves indicate any more information about what potentially they were feeling? Are there common trends and observations that you see over a longer period of time?
I don't think we could answer that. I mean, we really don't know what they were thinking. I can tell you that men tend to choose more lethal means than women, but that's about what we know. So, and so rather than talking about, you know, how can we trace back? I think we really have to talk about what can we do with the people who are still alive.
We're heading in for the news, but after that, we'll be speaking about the state of mental health among Malaysians. Do you think we're a society open enough to have discussions to help those with mental health issues? And did you know that suicide is considered a crime here in the country? We'll be discussing this and more after the 6:30 news. Don't go anywhere. It's the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Be free-minded. BFM 89.9.
Good evening, I'm Ezra Zayed alongside Caroline Oh, and we're speaking about the other silent killer that everyone chooses not to talk about, mental health issues and suicides. The stigma attached to it has prevented many of those affected from seeking the help and treatment they need. And our guest this evening, clinical psychologist Dr. Chua Suk Ning, aims to change that mindset by launching the hashtag I'm Not Ashamed campaign earlier this year to combat the negativity surrounding mental health issues. We'll get into that a little later, but first, Dr. Chua, let's zoom out a little bit more and talk about suicide. Now, under Section 309 of the Penal Code, it's a crime here in Malaysia. Whoever attempts to commit suicide shall be punished with imprisonment for a term which may extend to 1 year or a fine or both. And do you think this approach is effective as a deterrent?
Right. Officially, not that many people have actually been jailed for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there is no evidence that it is an effective deterrent.
Right.
I think what's more effective, based on the research, is putting in place steps to take away means of of suicide. For example, when they actually ban certain chemicals like carbon monoxide, and they made it less readily available in the UK, you could actually see a drop in suicide numbers when they took away those means. And that's why you see bridges, they have gates, you know, walls to prevent people from jumping down. And so we can actually see that the correlation when these means are put up is more effective in decreasing the rate of suicide than any sort of threat of jail time.
As in putting barriers to access.
That's right.
Right.
So decreasing access to different means of suicide. I think that one of the consequences of the penal code is that instead of discouraging people, it actually stigmatizes people more. It's not a very, I think, a compassionate approach to someone who's suffering to say, hey, you know what, you're suffering, we'll jail you because of that. I think rather than thinking about jail time or criminalizing them, we got to think about what can be more effective means if we consider that they are suffering at that point.
And do you think that that sort of policy actually puts a brake on conversations surrounding suicide?
I think so. I mean, I don't think people want to talk much about crime or, you know, people may use it as a threat. Like, don't commit suicide, it's a crime.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't really address the person's suffering, you know. And it's not that to just say we're going to idolize it or glorify it in any way. But we have to recognize that people who see that as an option are suffering.
There was a national health morbidity survey done by our health ministry. This was a couple of years ago. And the survey showed that 30% of Malaysians over 16 years of age experienced some form of mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only about 11-odd% back in 2006.
Right.
Is it just more data that we're working with? What do you think contributed towards this particular increase?
Yeah, I don't think there's more data, actually. So the rate, that would be about 1 in 4 people, which is quite close to sort of the global rate of developed countries, which is about 1 in 5 people have a mental health condition. And recent research actually suggested that the population between ages 18 to 44, 87% of people between that age range had in their lifetime some sort of mental health condition.
Mm.
So, in fact, right now, it's common to experience symptoms of depression or symptoms of anxiety, obviously less common maybe are illnesses such as schizophrenia and bipolar. But so I think what we see now that increases, there's real no real data on what had predicted that increase, but if I would postulate, I would say that part of it is the development of our nation, because that really models what we see in other countries, but as well as not having good preventative measures. So by not talking about it, by not putting in place support, even at the school level, at the university level, at companies, I think that has really cost us good mental health.
All right, let's continue on access to, I suppose, it's access, isn't it, to mental health professionals mm-hmm. and the rest. You've launched a campaign mm-hmm. To demonstrate both the prevalence and normality of mental health issues. Mm-hmm. It's called hashtag I'm Not Ashamed. This was launched in February. Mm-hmm. We talked about this on the show.
Yeah.
Let's hear it from you. Why don't you tell us about it in your own words?
Right, so the I'm Not Ashamed campaign actually started in the States. And there, you know, I think somewhat in a more individualistic culture and a culture that's more used to talking about such issues, it was really only used for individuals who had a mental health condition. And so even when I'm talking to my friends from abroad, they said, like, it doesn't make sense for everyone to join in the campaign. But I told them that in our collectivistic culture, it actually makes a lot of sense for us to come together as a community. So not just identifying or singling out people with a mental health condition and say, oh, okay, you're not ashamed. I think we, if you never had a mental health condition, we could have attitudes of shame towards other people who has. We don't want to be associated with that. And that's really what stigma means. It means like a mark. And so we don't want to hold up that sign in case someone says, you're sick or you're crazy or, you know, like, what's wrong with you? And I think we want to break that by saying everyone, whatever, wherever you lie on the continuum of mental health, let's not be ashamed of one another. Let's not be ashamed of this topic.
And if we were to look at, I guess, what options were available. So let's say this campaign becomes a success, right? And we have people acknowledging some of these problems.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people have this perception that, you know, if you can't talk to family, if you can't talk to friends, the options to go to seek professional help is sometimes beyond their means.
Mm-hmm.
What options are available? And I can imagine that we can go through a wish list as well of the things that we'd like to see government do, what we'd like to see happen in schools. But what do we have exactly right now?
What you have right now, so if you think that you have a mental health condition, right now you should go to your GP. To go with the public route, your GP will give you a letter referral to make an appointment with a psychiatry clinic in a public hospital. You present yourself there, you meet a psychiatrist, and often the psychiatrist will recommend medication. And that's one of the reasons why we were talking about remedy to play and psychotherapy is that psychotherapy in Malaysia is not really that well received yet. You know, so medication, I think, is definitely warranted in many cases. But the research shows that the combination treatment of psychotherapy and medication is sort of the best for many mental health conditions.
Why is it not well received?
I think first of all, I think there's this idea and a stereotype that, you know, you lie on this couch and you just talk about feelings. And I don't want to talk about feelings.
And your psychiatrist is either Fraser Crane or Robin Williams. It's one of the two.
Yeah, exactly. Or you have to be quite severe, you know. And it's also, it's a difficult process. I think therapy, I would never say it's easy. And I've been through my personal therapy as well. I think it's important for all psychotherapists and psychologists to experience that. It's not easy to delve into your inner world and to explore your thoughts and to find out discrepancies. But those things have long-lasting effects on your life. So medication can deal with symptoms. But in terms of causing long-lasting change to your behavioral patterns or equipping you with skills to deal with stress, it can't do that. And that's why I think psychotherapy is so effective.
Right. So you're in Singapore now,
That's right.
and that's where you're working with the National Institute of Education under the Nanyang Technological University. I mean, is that the reason you had to move to Singapore, because it's not well received here in Malaysia? You know, we're not talking about very sophisticated industry as of yet.
Yeah. Is that why I moved to Singapore? I moved to Singapore actually because it was easier for me to do research there. To be honest, the funding situation is better in Singapore. And so I felt like the best way for me to contribute to the development of psychology in Malaysia was to have access to funding that will allow me to run studies to develop effective interventions that I could then implement in Malaysia as well.
What could encourage the public sector to reconsider its attitudes towards psychotherapy? And is it changing rapidly enough, or are there encouraging signs?
Well, right now we have one psychologist to 100,000 people. So, you know, we still don't have many. I think, I mean, I've heard from my students that their parents discouraged them to going to psychology because there are no job prospects. And so I really think that...
I think that's a long-running joke now.
Yeah, 100,000.
Yeah, yeah. So what I tell them is that, you know, it may not be a lucrative career, but I trust that actually the trajectory is heading there. You know, we are becoming more open to psychotherapy. In the public sector, we don't have enough, so there often it is a very long waiting list. In the private sector, unfortunately, it's still quite costly.
It's very costly.
Let's be honest, it's very costly. Yeah. And on average, it costs for a clinical psychologist $350 per session, which is very expensive.
If you're lucky.
Yeah, I feel the pinch. You know, it can go up to $850, maybe $1,000. And so I think that as clinical psychologists, obviously I can't regulate my peers. I can only encourage them to consider how, if they can make their treatment more affordable, to at least kind of push it a little lower so that to reach more people. But you know, I'm not going to be idealistic that way. So instead, what I'm going to do is what we are planning now at Relate is to see, can we develop community interventions? So one thing that I've been thinking about is training lay people and equipping them with really basic counseling skills, and as well as how to deal with sort of crisis intervention, and as well as a community online clinic that will be staffed by interns but also supervised by clinical psychologists, so we can offer treatment at a reduced rate. And the great thing about it is that right now you see that a lot of the resources are centered in KL. But, you know, mental illness doesn't know location. And so by having it online and saying, like, which online therapy has been shown to be tremendous, as effective as actually traditional face-to-face therapy, then people all over Malaysia can kind of call in and Skype in and talk to their therapist.
And has that been a real boon, the fact that, you know, internet connectivity is kind of cutting through all of this, I guess, hindrance of seeking mental help?
I think so. I mean, I'm really pleased and I'm really trying to take advantage of technology as much as possible. I think, you know, sometimes it's a double-edged sword,
yeah,
and we have to be careful about it. We have to put into place policies that protect privacy and really wanting to be ethical. I think we're at the point where we can't afford not to do anything. And so let's take advantage of technology and make it work for us instead.
Dr. Chua Suk Ning, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
If you think you may be suffering from mental health issues, if you think you're suicidal or depressed, or perhaps you know someone who is, please reach out to Befrienders Malaysia. That's at 03-7956-8145. Once again, that's 03-7956-8145. Or you can email them at sam@befrienders.org.my. You can also log on to www.imalive.org, a global online crisis network. That's That's www.imalive.org and speak to their trained volunteers. You can download this podcast on our BFM app, which you can get from Apple's App Store or Google Play. Look for the podcast titled hashtag I'm Not Ashamed and share it, because you never know just who you'd be helping. This has been the Evening Edition with Caroline O and myself, Ezra Zayed. Playing us out is Chris Cornell with his song taken off the soundtrack of the film Great Expectations back in 1998. This is Sunshower.
Dark hills, roses, and finest air. I feel your healing in your sting again. I hear you laughing, and my soul is saved. On forgotten graves, you cry.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.